This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange.
Lloyd!
Yes!
Abortion!
No!
Roe v. Wade has got to go!
Lloyd!
Yes!
Abortion!
No! Roe v. Wade has got to go!
The March for Life took place in D.C. this weekend, as it has every year since the Roe v. Wade decision made abortion legal way back in the 70s. But this year, marchers felt more upbeat than they have in some time, with top leadership in Washington opposed to abortion and success in many states restricting abortion access. Also, the event itself got more media attention after President Trump and others complained about all the coverage the Women's March on Washington had received. Republican activist Fran Wendelboe made that case recently on The Exchange.
It just is so many things with the Trump candidacy is the biased media argument. I think here, too, is another example of that. And that's unfortunate because there are people speaking out there as well and ignored by the mainstream media for the most part.
Today in The Exchange, with two back-to-back marches on Washington promoting very different messages on abortion, we look at how Granite Staters feel about this. It's all part of NPR and NHPR's effort to follow the first 100 days at the White House and the State House. Let's hear from you this hour. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests in studio with us. Jennifer Frizzell is here, Vice President for Public Policy of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. And Jen, it's nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Shannon McGinley, board member of the group Cornerstone Action. And Shannon, good to see you too, and welcome back to you too.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, Shannon, I'll start with you. What's your reaction to these almost back-to-back demonstrations, as I said, with very different messages about abortion?
Well, the timing was interesting because of the inauguration and then the Women's March in D.C. But the pro-life march has been happening in Washington, D.C. for 44 years around the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, which falls on January 22nd every year. And so it's been really a testament to the passion that people have that's been consistently going on for 44 years. And I am always inspired by the number of young people that attend the March for Life as well. And I think that they were even energized by some of the recent moves of the Trump administration as well. And to have a vice president there to speak at the march too really energized the crowd, and speakers like Mia Love, Congresswoman Mia Love from Utah and so forth too. So it was a great experience for a lot of people.
There were a lot of cross comparisons last week, Jen Frizzell, about this, you know, the march on Women's March on Washington and then the March for Life. And conservatives complained that, you know, one got more attention than the other. I just wonder what your thoughts were seeing, again, these back-to-back events.
Well, you know, the women's marches and rallies were some of the most attended events that we've really ever seen in Washington in our lifetime. And they didn't just involve a gathering in Washington. There were 914 cities across this country and across the globe where women and men who care for them and share a sense of justice, you know, came together to share their dreams and to share their fears as the Trump administration was settling in during that weekend.
And in terms of the abortion issue, Jen, a lot of the marchers at the Women's March, it wasn't just about abortion. Obviously, there were lots of other issues, but there was a very pro-abortion rights message at those rallies and some of the supporters. There were some people who called in when we did a show on the Women's March who said, hey, you know, I support human rights, I support, you know, healthcare, I support diversity, all the things that the women were marching for. But I'm pro-life and I feel shut out. And I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, I know both in Concord here and in Washington, the organizers attempted to be very intersectional in bringing together groups and movements that are committed to work together in the years ahead and in the new administration, and making sure that women have access to the health care and the tools to control their own destinies was a very core value of those groups gathering together. We hoped here in New Hampshire at the Concord March that people would gather for many different purposes, really, to, you know, protect our rights, our health, our safety, our democracy, our environment. And we looked for opportunities for people to have an on-ramp to come to that day, should they support any one of those issues.
We got an email from Patrick in Rollinsford before the show who says, according to a CNN poll, as many as a third of would-be Democrats are pro-life, including myself. I had to sit this election out because of the Democratic platform that included repeal of the Hyde and Helms amendments. Patrick says pro-life Dems believe in all the usual Democratic ideals that make it easier to have a family, universal health care, paid family leave, strong social safety net, as well as advocating for the least among us, refugees, poor, and naturally, he says, the unborn. He says a couple other things, but he concludes by saying, open the big tent. And again, Jen, I just wonder how you'd respond to Patrick. And Shannon, I want to hear from you, too.
Well, you know, at Planned Parenthood is a nonpartisan organization. You know, it's not my place to speak to the platform of a particular party. However, abortion's been legal in this country for more than 40 years. And the reality is a vast majority of Americans support access to safe and legal abortion, and they have for decades. And it's a deeply personal decision and must be left to the individual woman, her family, without government interference, without political ideology, and without bad science leading towards barriers for her health.
Well, and on that point, Jerry on Facebook, Jen, agrees with you. He says, in an ideal world, no woman would need to decide whether or not to terminate a pregnancy. However, Jerry says this is not an ideal world. Unintended or unwanted pregnancy can happen due to the failure of birth control method, rape or incest. Even receiving the devastating diagnosis of fetal anomalies can be a cause to consider terminated pregnancy. Jerry says the decision to terminate a pregnancy is not an easy one or made cavalierly. It is a deeply personal decision, as you said, Jen, that must be left to the pregnant woman with no governmental interference. And Shannon, I'm going to throw that one to you. This is an argument that we often hear, that it is not the government's role to make this decision.
Well, I feel like that having abortion out there as an option for women really sells them out in a lot of ways. I feel that we should be assessing what are the issues that are going on in her life that would lead her to make such a difficult decision. You know, abortion was going to be the answer to all of these various social ills, and the feminization of poverty has increased exponentially since Roe versus Wade. And, you know, I remember Frederica Matthews Green. She was a feminist. She used to be pro-abortion and is now pro-life. And she used the analogy that a woman who has an abortion doesn't make that decision as though, you know, she's choosing an ice cream cone or buying a car, but rather like she feels she has no other choice, like a dog caught in a trap who gnaws off his own leg in order to break free, that she doesn't truly feel like she has a choice, but rather, I felt like I had no other choice. And something else that she said that really stuck with me, she used the analogy about, you know, if you had an animal rescue place and you noticed that one of the mammals, let's say that it was a whale, was behaving in such a way that was destroying their own child, that was beating on themselves, trying to deliberately cause a miscarriage, the keeper would say, what's going on environmentally that's causing this animal, you know, to do this? And how can we help them change those environmental factors? And I think that that is what would really be liberating to women, to address those issues that are going on in her life, be it economically, emotionally, familially, whether she feels that she's threatened by the father of the child or other family members, and address those so that she feels like that she can truly make a choice for life and have those around her supporting her.
What do you think, Jen?
Well, you know, I think that at Planned Parenthood, we believe that women are very moral agents and capable of bringing together those individuals in their life who are important to them when they make decisions about whether to continue a pregnancy, whether to terminate a pregnancy, or whether to explore adoption. I think that it would be nice if all of those on the opposite side of the abortion issue could join us in the work that's been done most recently to expand access to birth control for women. We know that with the Affordable Care Act and with several other policies that have made birth control more affordable, that women now have an increasing ability to plan for their family life, to prevent unintended pregnancy. And in fact, in the last year, we've seen abortion rates at a record low because women have had increased access to birth control. So I stand by the view that women are entitled to control their own destiny, and that they should have the tools in order to plan and complete their education, whatever steps they wish to take before they're ready for the weighty responsibility of having a child and raising a family.
Well, and abortion has gotten caught up in this whole women's health sort of political statements, and I've got an email to that effect. Amanda asks, why isn't there more focus on separating women's health issues from abortion? Abortion is, in some cases, related to mom and baby health, but most times, Amanda says, it's more of a circumstantial support issue. I want to hear from both of you on that, but maybe to you first, Shannon, this idea of separating women's health from abortion. Thank you, Amanda, for the email.
I think it's difficult to separate the two because they're inherently connected with one another. And I feel that with women, I feel like that there's this attitude out there that women can't continue their education or they can't continue their careers because they have to somehow make their bodies to be like a man, that the culture is not accepting women for their beautiful reproductive ability. It's not a disease. Their fertility is not a disease that needs to be fixed. It's fixed. It's something rather that needs to be celebrated, and that the rest of the culture should be accepting of the way that women's bodies work. Why are we trying to sterilize ourselves and to strip ourselves out of what makes us unique and what makes us beautiful, what makes us awesome? You know, we're not the same as men. We're absolutely equal as men, but we're not the same. And we should be celebrating that and having the rest of the culture accept that and celebrate that as well.
I wonder what you think, too, Jen. This has been a criticism of Planned Parenthood and other organizations that, you know, can there be more of a separation from that overall women's health issues, you know, the pap smears and, you know, procedures that everybody basically supports. People want women to be healthy gynecologically and otherwise. And the abortion. And again, it's to Amanda's point about why not make more separation between these two.
Well, I think that abortion has been a part of comprehensive reproductive health care from the perspective of who the trained professionals are, where the spectrum of the continuum of women's reproductive lives are. And, you know, to separate it out is really to ignore the recognition of the prevalence of how important abortion has been in keeping women healthy and in ensuring that they don't resort to mechanisms that are unsafe or self-induced. You know, the best estimate is that 1 in 3 American women will have an abortion in her lifetime. And so it's a significant number of women. More than 95% of them suggest that they believe it was the right decision for them. They do not have any regret. And it's important for them when they need to explore that decision and potentially have that medical procedure to have access to quality healthcare providers and to not have abortion stigmatized or separated out as if it's not a part of their reproductive life.
Well, and here's an email from Nancy, and I won't read the whole thing, but she says, I've been advocating for women's rights to choose for years and years. I'm old enough to remember backstreet abortions and don't want us to see us go back. We just can't, Nancy says. I marched in Washington years ago, hoping that that would be the last time. Nancy, thank you so much for the email. And, you know, we've all heard the horror stories, Shannon, about women who had those back alley abortions and got infections and died and all sorts of terrible things happening. So people say, if you ban abortion, that's going to happen again. Women will die from these unsafe abortions.
Well, those abortionists and those back alley abortion clinics that existed, before Roe versus Wade, all that Roe versus Wade did is move them to the front of the alley. Those same kind of individuals still are doing abortions in the clinics. You know, look at Dr. Kermit Gosnell in Philadelphia and what he was doing to women there. You know, even in if we really cared about women's health, we would have laws like that we do not have in New Hampshire, which is to protect the clinics, to have them live up to clinic standards of other ambulatory centers, to make sure that they're being safe. But the other side constantly pushes back on those kinds of initiatives in order to make the clinics to be safe. And I feel there again, I go back to my statement before that we can do better than abortion for women that find themselves in a crisis pregnancy, and that we think it's not just a matter of these back alley clinics, but we want to truly help their health and not put them at risk for abortion.
Well, and I've heard about these clinic regulations bills coming up in other states, including Texas. This was a big headline. Definitely want to talk about that. And I'm glad you're bringing us to the point where we talk about rules and regulations here in New Hampshire. But let's go to our listeners first, if we could. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, again, we're looking at how Granite Staters feel about abortion, given that there was the annual March for Life in Washington this year, coming shortly after the Women's March on Washington, which had a pro-abortion rights message. We're looking at how Granite Staters reflect on these two events, how they feel about abortion. And a little bit later, we'll talk about some of the laws and policies that may be coming down at the State House on this. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Susan's calling from Bristol. Hi, Susan. You're on the air. Welcome. Hey, Susan, are you still there? All right. I hope Susan calls back. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. I want to ask both of you about how people feel about this. I mean, we all have our own feelings, obviously, but the Gallup poll has been asking people about this. Pew asked people about it. There have been a number of other polls. The Gallup poll asked Americans how they feel about abortion, have been doing so for a long time. Here's what they found. If you ask Americans, do you consider yourself pro-life or pro-choice? So sort of those very stark categories. It's almost evenly split. But if you ask, do you think abortion should be legal under any circumstances? 29% say yes. Alternatively, if you ask, should abortion be illegal all the time? 19 say yes. So most Americans, Jen, seems like are somewhere in the middle. You've got 29 saying yes, legal all the time. 19 saying no, illegal all the time. Everybody else sort of falls in the middle.
Well, you know, I think it's, you know, politicians and the media that sometimes like to put people in organized categories and use labels that don't accurately reflect the experience that people have around issues as significant as pregnancy and childbearing decisions. You know, abortion is a very complex and personal decision. There are many shades of gray that impact people's personal decision making and life circumstances. The same women who choose abortion at one stage of their life may already be parents or may become parents at another stage in their life. And so, you know, we try to really recognize that women and families, you know, need to be treated with their own circumstance, and that when you try to put people in one bucket or another, that you're really failing to listen to the kinds of conversations that they want to have about the significance and personal nature of these issues.
Well, I like the way you put it. You really, it seems like, given this Gallup poll anyway and other polls, you can't put people in the same bucket, as you say, Jen. So what are some instances, I'll turn to you first, Jen, where people who in general might support access to abortion, where they would say, no, I'm not in that bucket. I'm uncomfortable.
Well, you know, I think it goes back to everyone's experiences is unique. And, you know, you can't walk in someone else's shoes around something so significant as a lifelong decision about bringing a child into your family. And so I think that, you know, there are individuals who associate their own values with what the terms pro-life or pro-choice mean. And, you know, instead, I think we prefer to just have conversations with people about the issues at hand, whatever they might be.
What do you think, Shannon, about that polling? Again, smaller numbers of Americans say all the time or never. And then there is this big group in the middle.
I think that Jennifer articulated that very well, that it is difficult to label people, and they are deeply personal experiences. And I think about the many women who I have counseled and interfaced with that have had abortions and the struggles that they have had after that abortion, where they thought that that was going to solve the problem, and it actually only piled on to more. And they're dealing with a great amount of emotional pain, and in some cases, physical pain, feelings of guilt, feelings that with the children that they do have that have been born, feeling like, why were they able to survive and my other baby didn't? Anger towards the individuals who pushed them into that situation to have that abortion. It's a lot of emotion involved.
Well, coming up, we'll hear from the New Hampshire ACLU on this and later from the New Hampshire Catholic Diocese. All that plus your emails and phone calls, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a week after the Women's March on Washington, which we covered on The Exchange, there was a March for Life in D.C. this past weekend that we're talking about today. Vice President Mike Pence spoke at the event, saying that 44 years ago, the Supreme Court made a huge mistake when it legalized abortion.
Today, three generations hence, because of all of you and the many thousands who stand with us in marches like this all across the nation, life is winning again in America.
That's Vice President Mike Pence speaking at the March for Life in Washington this past weekend. Let's bring you into our conversation today in The Exchange. The number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Jennifer Frizzell, Shannon McGinley, let's go right back to our listeners. And Susan is calling in from Bristol. Hi, Susan. Are you there?
Hi, I am.
Sure, go ahead.
I attended my first march when I was a college student at the age of 18, and I have seen two sides of this issue. Firstly, as a diehard pro-lifer who was, you know, easily marching up that hill with those signs that said, choose life, not abortion. And then at the age of 22, I was raped by a stranger and I conceived a child, and I found myself faced with, do I really believe what I'm marching about? And I felt a great and instant compassion towards all women who have an unplanned pregnancy. And I chose to keep my baby. And she's now going to be 22 years old. She's a wonderful young woman. She's been through a lot, but in the end, I'm so glad that I chose life. And my children and I have marched we've traveled from New Hampshire down to Washington, D.C. about a dozen times over the years to continue in that march. And I think the one thing that sets it apart from the Women's March is the perseverance. Like they said earlier, it's been 44 years that we've gathered to try to, you know, show women that there is a better choice. I think that abortion in some ways becomes an expectation in an unplanned pregnancy, and it limits the power that women actually have. I speak from experience. I chose life, and it was hard, but I'm so glad that I did, and I rose to a higher level than society ever expected me to rise to.
Well, Susan, what a story. So thank you so much for sharing that story, and let's take another caller. This is Garrett in Manchester. Hi, Garrett. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling in regards to, well, with the abortion and the fact that I'm pro-abortion on the fact that because of the possibility of rape for women that can't afford a child, and I have a significant other that was sexually abused as a child, and this is, I just find it ridiculous that they're not giving the woman an option. Yes, I believe that the health and everything else should be considered, or they should be, and I also don't want it to be abused, obviously, because there's no reason for it to be abused. But it also should be a possibility for women that just are abused.
Well, Garrett, thank you for the phone call. So both of you, two very different views, actually, both talking about a similar thing, a woman who comes upon a pregnancy through a not loving situation, clearly. So I don't know if you guys have any comments on that. I mean, these are very compelling stories, Jen, but, you know, it just shows that people approach this so differently, even when they have similar narratives.
Well, you know, Susan tells a positive and inspiring story about her own choice, I think. But the important thing is that she had the ability to make that choice. And I mean, certainly the issues that both these callers raise about sexual assault and trauma, they are really important. And individuals, women's experiences and what it might mean to have a child born of such violence is really important to be respectful that every woman's choice and every woman's circumstance is unique and needs to be honored. I would also point out that, you know, increasingly women seeking abortion are lower income and vulnerable status. Often they don't have access to the health care and the birth control that they would need or the information to plan and space those pregnancies. And so there are a lot of situations where women don't really have the same amount of resources that would allow them to raise a child in a way that is not just healthy, but even at a survivor level for themselves and that child's future.
I have an email I want to share. This is from Stacy in Ashland, who says, in 1974, my mother was pregnant with her third child when she got chicken pox. Her doctors told her significant harm had occurred to the fetus. After agony and heartbreak, she chose to terminate. I was conceived the month her lost child was to be born. Wow, Stacy, what a story. My siblings and I grew up knowing that abortion is never simple and the issue is not black and white. More importantly, Stacy says politics should never get involved in a woman's right to her body or that of a doctor providing all safe medical options. I wonder what you think, Shannon. We heard from callers talking about rape and abuse, and then we've got this situation of a fetus with significant harm. Are there instances where your organization, where your side of this issue would feel like an abortion was okay, where it was acceptable?
Well, it gets into complicated matters of how you define abortion. If, say, for example, that a woman has cancer, she's pregnant, and she undergoes chemotherapy, and one of the side effects is that the baby may die as a result of the chemotherapy, that is not defined as an abortion. There's a lot of confusion about what is an abortion and this, you know, the health of the mother and so forth. And so I think that needs to be made very clear. You know, we hope that a woman who finds herself in a health situation and being pregnant, that she can continue the pregnancy until, you know, 20-something weeks so that the baby can be delivered and then she can undergo treatment if, in fact, those two lives are in competition with one another. But we strongly believe that a physician who has to view this as that he has two patients, he or she has two patients, and that to do everything that we can to save both of them. And then certainly in the case of rape or incest, you know, I have two friends that were conceived by a rape situation. They're my age. And can I look at them and tell them that they're less of a human being because of the way that they were conceived and that their father was a horrible person? I feel like it's unfair that they receive capital punishment. The child receives capital punishment for the crime of the father. And I know that these women have gone on to have families of their own, and they're very grateful that they've been able to continue this. So I think that sometimes we have to realize that unplanned pregnancy or unplanned crisis can also lead to unplanned joy, that we have to be open to that as well.
There is the story from Stacy, though, where it isn't a rape or an assault. It's that the infant had significant harm because of the smallpox. So I just wonder how you view that, Shannon, where you know this baby is going to be, have a lot of problems, significant health problems, may not survive.
Who's to say that they may not survive? We don't know. We know of all different kinds of situations where we're told that. I mean, I was told with my last pregnancy that my baby had something significantly wrong with him, and was even recommended by one of the physicians that we saw to have to terminate the pregnancy.
Really?
And we chose not to. And Aiden has turned out to be completely healthy. And so, you know, sometimes they're wrong and we want to err on the side of life. We would never shoot a bullet into a room in hopes that no one was present. We always lost errs on the side of life. And so we want to be able to say, we have two patients, we're going to do everything that we can to save them. And just because they have some sort of a disability doesn't make them less of a human being, because then we get into eugenics and that's very dangerous ground.
Do you want to jump in, Jen?
Well, I think what I would just say
is a scary word.
Is the range of topics that the callers have brought up thus far this morning really demonstrate why it's inappropriate for government and legislators to be the one who are, you know, proclamating and legislating one size fits all restrictions or solutions, if you will, to the issues that are so unique and so personal that they really belong as part of the practice of medicine and as part of individual women's lives and decision making.
Well, speaking of legislating, I do want to focus now on what may be happening here in New Hampshire. We've talked a lot nationally, how people feel nationally, the marches in Washington. But let's focus more on New Hampshire. And for that, we're going to talk to two people involved in this, the ACLU and a little bit later, the Catholic Diocese of Manchester. Devin Chafee is with us now. She's executive director of the ACLU of New Hampshire. Hi, Devin. Good morning.
Hi, Laura. Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, lots to talk about, Devin, but if we could just focus with you, what are the top abortion-related bills that you at the ACLU are going to be looking at the legislature this year?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So here at the ACLU, we are very much focused on three efforts currently before the New Hampshire legislature that we feel would significantly erode a women's reproductive rights in our state. The first of these is what we call a fetal personhood measure, which is a bill that would recognize a fetus as a person who can be an independent victim of a crime, independent of the pregnant woman. And we really see this bill as part of an incremental strategy to establish a framework that erodes the rights recognized in Roe v. Wade, because it really pits fetal rights against women's rights. It really recognizes the independent rights of a fetus. And we also feel that this bill is very unnecessary because New Hampshire law already recognizes the additional loss of a miscarriage and stillbirth that result from violent crime. The second measure that we're focused on is one that has been called a quote-unquote viability ban, and that's been proposed in HB 578. And this bill uses medically and legally very unsound terminology to put unnecessary and very onerous restrictions on medically indicated terminations that occur later in pregnancy. A lot of things can go wrong late in pregnancy. You know, women's health can be put at risk in ways that are very, very difficult to predict or imagine. And when those complications develop, we feel strongly that a woman needs to be able to get the care that she needs. And unfortunately, HB 578 includes very limited and, again, medically unsound definitions that really put women's health at risk and limits the ability of doctors to be able to do what they feel is in the best interest of the health of their patients.
Can you be sorry to interrupt, Devin. Can you be a little more specific on that viability ban? Does that mean after X number of weeks, you know, abortions would not be allowed? Is that what that means?
Essentially, the way that the bill is structured is after 21 weeks, it creates a certain hoops that a woman and her doctor have to jump through, pretty onerous hoops, in order to terminate a pregnancy. Now, these are some of the most difficult decisions that women have to make in their life, most often involving very wanted pregnancy and very complicated health issues. And to create additional restrictions on how a physician, a woman along with her physician are making these determinations, you know, pose very concerning risks to the health of pregnant women.
Okay, and there was another bill you wanted to talk about, Devin. Go ahead.
Sure. The final bill is really a bill that we're concerned of primarily from a privacy perspective. And this is a bill that targets abortion providers and women who have abortions for very onerous data collection. This is a particularly expensive proposal. It carries a fiscal note of $130,000 for the first year and tens of thousands of dollars in each subsequent year to establish a database within the New Hampshire Department of Vital Records and Statistics to collect information only on abortions. Now, the Department of Vital Records and Statistics doesn't collect any other information about any other medical procedure. It just targets, and this bill just targets abortion, which is one of the safest outpatient surgical procedures in the United States. And so it really, in doing so, singles out and stigmatizes abortion for this type of data collection. And of course, any time that you have the government collecting this type of information, it poses, you know, certain privacy risks.
Well, would names be collected with that data collection?
Well, it creates, and again, this is why the system is expensive, is it attempts to create certain numerical identifiers that it's putting with the that represent both the patient as well as the provider. But as we know, in the state of New Hampshire, if you're only talking, you could be talking about some very small communities where you still pose the risk is still there that people would be identified or that, you know, information at some point would be re-identified.
Well, and as we've seen, everything's hackable.
Yeah, well, exactly, Laura.
So go ahead,
Devin. I really think
yeah.
We see these, you know, all three of these bills, and they're similar to bills that we've seen year after year after year at the State House, and they're really part of a larger strategy. It's an incremental strategy that we're seeing not just here in New Hampshire, but nationwide, to erode a woman's ability to access abortion and to really undermine the rights that were established in Roe v. Wade. And so we're really going to be looking to our state elected officials to ensure that they continue to protect the rights of women in our state to be able to make their own medical decisions.
Well, Devin Chafee, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That's Devin Chafee, again, Executive Director of the ACLU in New Hampshire. And in a couple minutes, we'll hear from Meredith Cook. She's with the Catholic Diocese of Manchester. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Both of you, Jen Frizzell and Shannon McGinley, I did want to get your thoughts, too, on some of the bills that Devin told us about. Which ones stand out to you, Jennifer, as ones that you are especially keeping an eye on? She mentioned fetal personhood, a viability ban that would make it very hard to have an abortion after 21 weeks, and then this abortion database.
So we're concerned about all three of the bills that Devin references. You know, New Hampshire has a long and bipartisan history of keeping government interference away from these personal medical decisions. And, you know, we know that the legislature has taken seriously the role of government with regard to individuals' personal information. And so we will be supporting the same platforms as the Civil Liberties Union with regard to opposing these bills. We're also concerned about a bill that is pending to repeal New Hampshire's buffer zone law.
Yeah, yes, I'd like to talk to you about that.
Yeah. Enacted in 2013 and has really been living in a kind of place of limbo because of some court challenges that have consistently been rejected, but nonetheless have kept the implementation of that law from moving forward.
It is very confusing. We have this buffer zone law on the books, but it's never been used, so it can't be challenged in court until it's used. Is that right, Jen?
That's basically it. The lawsuits that have been pending to date have really been kind of preemptive lawsuits, attempting to have the law struck down even before its implementation. But there has yet to be a community where a reproductive health center and local officials have worked together to post a buffer zone.
So, as I said, in a moment, we're going to talk to Meredith Cook of the Catholic Diocese about what's on the diocese agenda in terms of abortion. But what about you, Shannon? We've got the buffer zone, the fetal personhood, the viability ban, and the abortion data collection. I wonder which other bills at the legislature you folks are especially watching.
Well, those are the ones that we are watching as
those
well.
Four.
Yes, that's correct. And the fetal homicide, though, is kind of a unique situation where we don't really view that as being a pro-life or a pro-choice kind of a bill. We just think that that's for the protection of these families who have had an unborn child that has been killed or damaged enough that the pregnancy could not continue, and that to be recognized in a homicide situation. And we've had a couple of examples of women who have testified in Concord throughout the hearings in the last couple of years that that this bill has been up there, of saying that, you know, their child was not recognized in the context of the penalties that may occur for example, the drunken driver or whatnot. And certainly in a domestic abuse situation, you can have the father, for example, seek to kill their unborn child, and he can't be liable in the same way as a person who was outside of the womb was murdered. So, you know, I don't think that it specifically excludes abortion in the language of the bill. So it's a little unfortunate that that has been brought up into this abortion debate, because I don't feel that it should be a part of it. And then, of course, the viability ban and the statistics. On the statistics bill, we are only one of three states that do not have reporting requirements. So it's very difficult for when people ask questions about, you know, what abortions are being done in the state of New Hampshire, where are they being done, who are they being done upon, why are they being done, so that we can better target women's health care. We don't know those answers.
So most states have that data collection.
Yes, only New Jersey and the District of Columbia do not have those.
Why do you think that's the case? New Hampshire's a big privacy state, so.
Right, but we can do things that can protect them. But yeah, it's been a real challenge to get that passed.
All right. I can see you want to jump in, Jen. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how Americans and Granite Staters feel about abortion, given the March for Life in Washington this weekend. It's all part of NPR and NHPR's effort to look at the first 100 days of the White House and the State House. The Exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Jennifer Frizzell, Shannon McGinley, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Meredith Cook is with us. She's director of the Office of Public Policy for the Diocese of Manchester. And Meredith, welcome.
Welcome. It's nice to be here today.
Well, and I asked Devin Chafee at the ACLU this same question. I'll throw it to you, Meredith. What are the top, perhaps, three bills that you at the diocese are looking at in the legislature this year in terms of abortion?
Well, and it's interesting. We enjoy working with the ACLU on a number of bills, but on these issues, almost the same bills that Ms. Chafee mentioned would be the ones that we also would be working on, but would have a very different perspective on House Bill 471 that she mentioned on statistics, and I believe Ms. McGinley already mentioned this as well. 47 states collect this information, and a bipartisan group in the House of New Hampshire House of Representatives worked to address the very issues that were mentioned in terms of privacy, to make sure that this information could be collected in a way that would address the very privacy issues that were concerned, and then it was defeated in the Senate. So if there are issues in terms of addressing privacy, I think people of good faith could get together and address those issues. So we are very hopeful that we can work together and get that done.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
And also House Bill 578, banning abortions after viability. That language was worked on to make sure that it's consistent with Roe versus Wade and its the subsequent cases in terms of making sure that it's the viability would be the standard, that it's something that could be consistent with those cases. So, again, if there are issues that need to be worked out, then I hope we could get together and we could work out those issues.
Viability means the fetus would be able to live outside the womb, so 21 weeks.
Correct. And I think it may be that may be that standard, but yes.
What about the fetal personhood bill, Meredith? Devin said, look, the law already recognizes the additional harm if a fetus dies in the course of a crime, that this is, you know, extra and it's covering to limit abortion.
There is a law that Devin brought up that provides for a crime, but it's not it is not fetal homicide. It does not recognize a Class A felony. It does not recognize a separate crime for the homicide of the child who has died. It does not recognize the homicide of the child who has died. So it's not recognizing the actual crime that has occurred, the loss that's occurred to that mother, to the family that's lost their child. So it is not an equivalent crime.
What about the buffer zone law that is in sort of legal limbo at this point, that, you know, I don't even want to get into what happened to this bill because it's gone back and forth so many times. Is that something that you folks at the diocese will be working on?
Yeah, absolutely.
Getting rid of this buffer zone, yeah.
House Bill 589, and we're hopeful, again, that that one will also be able to be repealed. There are a number of people who have provided peaceful witness outside of abortion clinics. And again, you know, those are people who may be on the basis of their faith, but it's also, if you look at the Massachusetts law that went up to the Supreme Court, the number of people who filed amicus or friend of the court briefs, it was not exclusively a faith perspective. There were labor unions that also were concerned about this. So there's a free speech concern here as well. So it's time for that law to be repealed.
And Meredith, just correct me if I'm wrong, Governor Sununu has said he would support repeal of that buffer zone. Is that correct?
I understand that that's the case.
Okay. Anything else, Meredith, that you want to leave us with?
No, I think in terms of the abortion bills, that would be those are the top priorities.
Okay. Thank you for being with us.
Great. Thank you very much.
Meredith Cook, Director of the Office of Public Policy for the Diocese of Manchester. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Both of you got an email from Angie, which actually talks about another law that we haven't talked about yet here in New Hampshire. Angie says, as a conservative Christian, I am pro-life, but since I live in a land where we have freedom of religion, it isn't up to me to tell other people to follow my religious beliefs, so I will not vote or elect someone based on their claims to overturn Roe v. Wade. Angie says, my bigger concern is for girls under 18 undergoing this procedure. She says, I would like to see a law that includes counseling for women both before and after. How do your guests feel about asking for an adult in a girl's life to essentially sign off on this? Now, my memory's fading on this, Shannon McGinley, so you're going to have to help me out. I know New Hampshire has gone back and forth on this issue of parental consent for girls under, I can't remember if it was 18 or 16 and so forth. Where does that stand?
Well, as far as I understand it, it's still, it is it is the law of the land here in New Hampshire. And what I would say to this particular woman is that one of the risks that you have about it being another adult is that you could have a young lady who is of underage, but then she could have a boyfriend who is over 18 who's pushing her into the abortion, and then he can be the one to take her to sign off. The other thing is that in a situation of sex trafficking, which unfortunately is becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and including here in New Hampshire, is that you can have their pimp or whatever it is that you want to call them, but their pimp who can be bringing them into the abortion clinic to have the abortion and sign off on it as well.
So because they're the adult.
They're the adult, correct. Correct. So that's of concern.
So the law in the state, Jen, says what about underage girls who are pregnant?
Well, we actually have a law now that was enacted in 2011, has been in effect since 2012, which requires young women under the age of 18 to have to demonstrate that one parent has been notified. We do not have a consent law where the parent is actually able to override the decision of the young woman.
That's a key word, notification.
These laws
not
are
consent.
Actually still problematic for young women who live in households where their parents are not able to be consulted with and not able to be supportive, even though it would ultimately be their decision. Those parents have been known to stand in their way, both physically and logistically. However, we also have worked with a group of New Hampshire lawyers to help young women who are in hardship situations have access to something known as the judicial bypass so that they are able to demonstrate to a judge that they're sufficiently mature to make the decision for themselves and ultimately override the parental notification law. It's an awful, arduous process for a young woman who's facing the stress of circumstances of an unintended pregnancy and unable to talk to her parents to also then find their way to a lawyer, tell their story over and over again, and get before the judge. And it's one of the reasons that we're concerned that this type of law, although there is a bypass, also results in some young women never finding their way to the abortion care that they're seeking.
Well, here's an email from Phyllis who says, regarding the comment that some women make the choice to abort because they feel they aren't able to afford to provide for a child, Phyllis says, first, there's always the option to choose to put the child up for adoption. But second, and even more importantly, it needs to be remembered that financial situations are temporary and can change in 9 months, let alone 9 years. Phyllis says the decision to abort is a permanent situation. Phyllis, thank you for the email. Here's one from Hannah, and she says, I'm a 39-year-old mother of two kids under 3 years old. Although I cannot imagine having abortion myself, I fully support the right to choose. She says, I think it's sad that this has become such a political issue when really it is a personal one. Many people vote solely based on the candidate's choice on abortion when there are so many other incredibly important things at stake. The single issue voting is negligent. Mary, thank you also for that email. Lots of comments, both of you. Let's go back to our callers. And Carrie joins us from Manchester. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much.
Sure.
So I just have a few things that I want to share because I feel so strongly about this. And I especially feel so frustrated that other people feel like they can tell me what I need to do with my body and put their religious or moral beliefs on me when it should be my decision. And this is not a decision that's taken lightly. My mom was raped when she was 17. She kept the baby, and I'm here today in my mid-20s. I had my first child. When I got pregnant with him, it was unexpected. And I was very strongly being pushed to have an abortion, and I almost did it, and I didn't. And I have a beautiful son now, but just because I see him and I see where he is now, I'm still pro-choice, and it's still not up to me to tell somebody else what to do. I had a second child that was planned. I'm on birth control, but the IUD fails, and I pay $520 a week right now for childcare so my husband and I can work full-time. If I had a third kid because my IUD failed, I can't afford another $270 a week for childcare. One of us would have to stop working. And when I do have to make a decision, if I did have to go in and have an abortion because I felt that was the right decision for me and my family, I would not want to go into a group of people throwing my decision in my face and showing me what I'm doing because I know what I'm doing. I researched it very extensively, and it's just my choice.
So support for a buffer zone, and we talked about that a little bit earlier. What do you think, Shannon? These buffer zones are very difficult territory between abortion, choice, free speech, and so forth.
Right. I think, you know, there's a little bit of a double standard here where those that are in the pro-abortion movement would say, you know, keep the government out of it. You know, this is a woman's choice. But there's also a free speech thing that's going on here as it relates to the buffer zone, and that these are public sidewalks. And when we start curtailing free speech for one, then we're all at risk. And that's one of the main premises of what our government was founded upon, was free speech. So we start to get on some really shaky ground when we start curtailing certain kinds of free speech.
Do you think Governor Sununu will support repeal of this buffer zone?
It seems as so, yes.
And that's a bill in the legislature, so that's making its way
correct
through. Yeah, go ahead, Jen. I can see you want to jump in.
Well, I think it's important to say that, you know, we recognize and support the right to free speech, and it's an important way we use our voices to advocate for the issues we believe in. The buffer zone law would not prohibit anyone from utilizing their free speech. What it does is it establishes some parameters, and it gives local officials and health centers the ability to establish up to a 25-foot parameter, which provides some separation. You can still hear people with a 25-feet distance. You can they can still have the opportunity to make their points. But the law was passed in either 2013 or 2014 after many people complained both to the health center and to the local police department about a level of harassment and verbal abuse and sometimes physical intimidation that they experienced when they are able to be approached directly, kind of in a bubble of their own space, as they try to make entrance or leave a health center. And it was those situations and those cases that led the New Hampshire legislature to enact this law. And, you know, Meredith Cook had mentioned earlier trying to make analogies to the Massachusetts law that was struck down. But New Hampshire's law has been carefully tailored to be unique and different. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's only applicable in communities where there has been a demonstrated issue of protester activity that's provided harassment or intimidation to patients. And we think it's capable of standing on its own constitutional firmity.
Go ahead, Jen.
It only makes sense to repeal this legislation in light of what did happen in Massachusetts. You know, the courts required the state of Massachusetts to pay back the attorneys of the plaintiffs $1.2 million. And knowing the fiscal situation that we're in the state of New Hampshire, I really do not feel that most taxpayers are looking forward to the idea of perhaps having to settle for plaintiff's fees to the tune of over $1 million, which could very well happen here in New Hampshire. So, you know, we haven't had the violence. There hasn't been those issues outside of the clinics. The people that are there are peaceful, prayerful, offering alternatives to the women that are going in, and, you know, there's children outside. It's just not necessary.
Well, lots of calls, both of you, and lots of activity on our Facebook page. So if you don't get on the air today, the conversation always continues on Facebook. So I just want to let everybody know that. Rosie on Facebook says, it's upsetting for me as a woman to hear Republican men, in capital letters, speak about why I am not a whole person and don't deserve full bodily autonomy. I feel these medical decisions should be kept between a doctor and their patient. It is that simple for me, Rosie says, and I will never go the other way. Thank you, Rosie. And then here's an email from Gabriel in Vermont. He says, I don't understand how Planned Parenthood can claim to be nonpartisan when they run so many political ads. I'm a big proponent of birth control and women staying healthy, but I find abortion to be a rather horrific, quote, procedure. Were I a doctor trained to do abortions, I know that there's no way I could or would partake in such an act. I wonder how many pro-abortion folks, Gabe says, would actually be comfortable doing it themselves. Gabe, thank you to the email. And just that first sentence there, Jen, I want to give you a chance to respond. Planned Parenthood says it's nonpartisan, but the organization has done a lot of political backing.
Well, at first, I'll use the moment to make a distinction, which is, you know, I'm here on behalf of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England, and we have 21 health centers across the region. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, and we do not engage in political activity. But we do have a sister organization, the Planned Parenthood New Hampshire Action Fund, and that separately funded does not have those limitations, and we do conduct issue campaigns as well as endorse candidates. You know, across the spectrum, the Action Fund has endorsed both Democrats and Republicans. Unfortunately, increasingly in New Hampshire, as the Republican platform gets more and more restrictive with regard to believing that life begins at conception and supporting abortion in no circumstances. It's been harder and harder to find those pro-women's health Republicans who support the same values that we do. But we're certainly always working with them and in every election cycle, working to find both Democrats and Republicans to carry our message.
So you're saying your message hasn't changed, it's the parties that have changed.
Certainly, the number of pro-choice, pro-women's health Republicans in the New Hampshire legislature has shrunk over the years as the Republican primary process tends to attack those individuals and make it harder and harder for them to serve in office.
Well, so speaking of politics, very quickly, Shannon, let's look ahead to the legislature, your hopes for 2017. You can respond either for the federal level or the state level. What do you hope to see happen?
Well, my primary, I would love to see the defunding of abortion so that taxpayer dollars were not being required to pay for abortions and abortion advocacy.
So the Hyde Amendment. For example.
Yes, but yes. And, you know, the issue of taxpayers giving money to groups like Planned Parenthood that do support the advocacy. And even though I understand there may be, you know, there's the 501c3, the 501c4, and then you have your political action committee, that legally there's these separations. We all know that at the end of the day, those monies are fungible and that you're still paying for the internet service. You're still paying for the computers. You're still paying for the phone service, the air conditioning, all of those, that overhead that also supports the political activity as well.
Well,
and taxpayers find that very offensive.
The funding we didn't even get to, and there's a lot going on with that at the federal and the state level. How about you, Jen? Top priority for 2017?
Well, you know, I guess what I would say with regard to those who are looking to reduce the number of abortions is at the end of the day, no organization does more to prevent the unintended pregnancies and the need for abortion than Planned Parenthood. And if opponents were serious about lowering the abortion rates in this country, then they would join us and work alongside us in this upcoming session and to push back what's going on in Washington to make sure that things like birth control, sex education, and preventative health care was more available rather than elbowing their way into medical decisions of the people of this country.
Well, not an easy topic. Thank you both so much for joining me this morning to cover it. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, thank Laura. You, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, lifting the hood on auto insurance. It's one of the few purchases we hope never to use. And in New Hampshire, drivers aren't required to insure their cars, though most do. But what's the best route to a fair price and adequate coverage? And how might technology, like devices that track driving habits, change the industry? Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 7 p.m. on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.